we have any questions, we'll hear from the other three. Professor Gerhard Niemeyer of the University of Notre Dame, who's been a member of the Philadelphia Society, I'm sure, since it was started. He's a trustee, spoken to us many times. Here, our next speaker here, Professor Niemeyer.
Speaking after Eric Voegelin means to take the podium after following a tour de force encompassing four centuries and manifestations of the human spirit on both sides of the fence. And one wonders what, after this time, there still remains to be said. The waterfront has been thoroughly covered. So I'm going to follow the recipe of a candidate of theology who was facing his examination the next morning, and he was wondering how he should prepare himself. And he said to his roommate, well, I expect there will be an Old Testament question and a New Testament question. And in the New Testament, I know the Lord's Prayer and the Beatitudes, and I think I'm pretty well prepared. Now, the Old Testament, that's another matter. It's so complex and so full, and I just don't know where to begin. O, said his roommate, just fix on one part of it and learn that and be prepared with that. So he sat down that evening and memorized the list of the kings of Israel, preparing, beginning with Saul and David and Solomon and Rehoboam and Jeroboam and so on, going down the list. And the next morning, sure enough, there was a question from the Old Testament and the New Testament. And on the question from the New Testament, he put in the Lord's Prayer and the Beatitudes, and he thought he acquitted himself with credit. The question of the Old Testament ran like this: compare and contrast the major with the minor prophets. And this was his answer: far be it from me to engage in invidious comparisons between two sets of such excellent gentlemen. Instead, I will give a list of the kings of Israel. I will now give a list of the kings of Israel. In the context of this meeting with its title, Freedom and Order, I should like to submit a thesis to you, very minor thesis. But one may relate its two concepts by saying possibly that freedom implies an emphasis on spontaneity and the endeavor to protect it against contrivance, particularly contrivance imposed by governmental power. In that endeavor, spontaneity itself remains an uncriticized assumption, which runs as a constant throughout all the discussions. Order, by contrast, implies an endeavor to examine critically mental assumptions and emotional attitudes in order to protect what is rational from what is irrational, and that in spontaneity as well as in governmental practices. Eric Voegelin has not been unsympathetic to the first standpoint, but the bulk of his work has been done from the second one. This year, the fourth volume of his Order in History has come to our hands. It contains an important change in the direction of his thinking about the problem of history, this problem which has been with us since the middle of the 18th century. In the form in which this problem has been put cast by Enlightenment and romanticism, it can itself be called an element of disorder. And Erik Vogelin has so characterized it. Since it plays no small role in the development of modern totalitarianism, both Marxism and Nazism, fascism, are centered on this problem of history. And that problem itself, as a problem, is anchored in two fundamental assertions. First, the assertion of the knowability, and second, the assertion of the progressivity of history. Indeed, these two assertions together amount to the assertion that history as an object of study exists and contains also an inescapable order. A quarter of a century ago, Erik Vogelin committed himself to the search for a theoretically intelligible order of history. The emphasis, of course, being on theoretical, that is, an order of history instructed by the highest philosophical insight and controlled by these highest philosophical insights. In the first three volumes of his Order in History, this led him to the concept of the leap in being. The leap in being was described as the historical event in human consciousness which amounted to a breaking out of the human mind out of the old cosmological order, an order in which gods, nature, society, and man formed a compact package, all in one tight little wrapping, all seen as an integrated whole. And the breaking out of that was a breaking out into a differentiated order in which righteousness was grasped either as the separate will of God standing over against man, or else as the experienceable structure of the human soul. Thus, over against a cosmological order which seemed to be the common patrimony of mankind all over the world, there appeared two decisive leaps in being, that of Israel and that of Greece. And these two, in turn, could be seen as related to the subsequent Christian order as its two Old Testaments, to use the terminology of Clement of Alexandria. Now, on the basis of these findings, Erik Vogelin formulated the pithy sentence, "The order of history is the history of order." And the order of history now appeared as a line from a universal, ubiquitous cosmological order through the two breakthroughs or breakouts, the two leaps in being, to the subsequent Christian doctrine, Christian order, by and large a single line, you might say, with a bulge in the middle somewhere where the two leaps occurred. Subsequently, however, Erik Vogelin changed his mind gradually in the course of the last 20 years. And he made this clear in the fourth volume. While it is still true that the order of history is the history of order, the history of order has turned out in his further research to be more complex than it appeared at the writing of the first three volumes. To put it more briefly than can possibly be digested at this time, The history of Oro turned out to contain more developments than could be possibly arranged on a single line. Not all the developments would fit on this single line, even if you allowed for the bulge in the middle. Both breakthroughs and derailments happened at other times than these two breakthroughs, and in various places, the leap in being was indeed confirmed as a crucial experience of man, of men, one should say, but one that possibly concerned a relatively small group of men living in a society which in itself continued to be ordered by the myth, so that both the order of the leap in being and the order of the myth continued side by side. And on the other hand, derailments occurred not only in the 19th century, such as Hegel, but a similar derailment already could be found among the Sumerians, and so on and so on. As I said, this is too brief to be digested. It is just a hint at what is contained in the fourth volume. Eric Boglin thus has ordered these new findings under the concept of ecumenical empire, the empire that brings together under one rule a number of societies, each of which has possessed its own order before being subjugated. And this transition from the order of smaller societies, each considered valid, to the larger order of the ecumenical empire, with something like a king of Asia or Roman emperor at its head, problems arise both for the conqueror and for the victims of this process. And also a new spiritual order of ecumenic dimension appears for the spiritual man, as is borne witness to by the ecumenic spiritual order of the so-called second Isaiah in the Bible, and also of St. Paul in the New Testament, besides which there are others like Mani and so on. Eric Boglin has called this progression in his own view of things by the title From History to Mankind. And the word mankind now occurs in his thinking in an emphatically different sense from, let us say, from the way in which it would be used by Toynbee. It is a final break. His thinking is the final break now with the remainder of a unilinear construction, a unilinear construction that is common to Condorcet, Hegel, Kant, Marx, and Toynbee. And this break was managed without giving away or giving up the concept of history. Surely a tremendous accomplishment from anyone who has ever worked in this field and has tried to escape from the unilinear conception of history and has found that he could only do it like Herbert Butterfield did it by saying there is no such thing as history or the meaning of history. Cosmological order and the leap in being constituted one of the two great poles of Eric Boglin's work. The other may be called, as it was called in the New Science of Politics, Gnosticism, the nature of modernity. Today, Eric Boglin has spoken to us about the revision and further development of that concept. Modernity may be said to contain as its most important element Enlightenment rationalism, Renaissance humanism, 19th century scientism, and an anti-theism that is common to all of these periods. New research, which Erik Vogelin has mentioned today, some of it only coming in the last 10 years, is shedding a different light on both Enlightenment rationalism and Renaissance humanism. The method developed by Hobbes and Descartes, for instance, a method which they both called decomposing and combining, resembles closely the way enjoined by the alchemists, which they called solve et coagula, and which had an exclusively magic character. Thus, upon closer examination, rationalism is found out to have the character of a contrivance, of human pretension to trick and manipulate and force the elements of creation, that is God's, in order to make something new, not as an honest craftsman, but rather as a rival of God. And that is true not only of Hegel, but emphatically also of Hobbes. As in the new science, Erik Vogelin has pulled together this research and shown its significance in the total picture which we have of our age and its antecedents. It turns out that both humanism and rationalism owe much to an underground stream of not only Gnosticism, but magic, instant holiness doctrines, panaceas of self-salvation, nature mysticism, and other spiritual irrationalities. In our view of the present situation, the image of the Renaissance has always been a major ingredient. That view, chiefly shaped by Jacob Burckhardt, tells us that man finally discovered his own possibilities, that he struggled free from the yoke of divine authority which had held him down for so long, that he was coming into his own, that he opened his eyes wide on the world which is his sole habitat. A development altogether healthy and emphatically innocent. The findings which Erik Vogelin has put before us today give the lie to this image, an image which itself now stands convicted of innocence, but the innocence of foolishness. It will no longer do to celebrate Pico della Mirandola as the youthful prophet of a wholesome humanism, when we discover that in that famous oration on the dignity of man, he quotes at the outset Hermes Trismegistus. And when we are aware that the Hermetic Corpus had just been translated by Ficino, as Vogelin mentioned, and when upon delving ourselves into that corpus, we find that the dignity of man is nothing but a Gnostic hypostatization of a transcendent acosmic principle in man. Two souls are ascribed to man, one working within the confines of nature, the other, quote, present in us as mind from the mind is superior in the motion that works becoming to the motion that works becoming, and it is through it that the liberation from the haimamene and the ascent to the intelligible God comes about. That is a quotation from a Hermetic text. Pico's humanism is thus tied with a Gnostic doctrine of self-salvation and the magic connected with that doctrine. One other example, at the other end of the time scale which was discussed today, it is customary to attribute to Alexander I of Russia the conception of the Holy Alliance and to brand this, contemptuously, as a typical manifestation of triumphalistic Christianity. We now find out that the predominant spiritual influence in Russia in the last quarter of the 18th century and the first decades of the 19th century was pietistic mysticism, and with it, a strong Rosicrucian presence. The aim of the Rosicrucians being to make oneself sinless like Adam before the fall. A press was set up in St. Petersburg from which poured, among other things, mystical and alchemical tracts of all sorts. Prince Trubetskoy, who belonged to these circles, envisaged a society of true believers as a means of achieving a new kind of earthly state and an international order foreshadowing the Holy Alliance. So the idea did not come from Christianity, but from mystical, heretical, self-salvational doctrines which came out from the underground of the 18th century. An assessment of our own time has become the endeavor of many first-rate minds of this century, among others Urs von Balthasar, Albert Camus, Henri du Lubac, Karl Löwit. Erich Vogelin has made his contribution in two works, The New Science of Politics and Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. He has surpassed himself and surpassed all others now in offering a revision of his former estimate and a far more accurate and detailed picture of the modern age than has come from the pen of any other writer. The shallow optimism which rooted in all too rosy portraits of both Renaissance and Enlightenment will no longer be possible now. The demons that have entered our contemporary life are not from yesterday and are not named only Hitler and Stalin. The time has come when we are finally compelled to face ourselves and our recent past in all honesty.